May it please the court. Wouldn't you know it'd be just my luck to have my first opportunity to argue before the Supreme Court and have to follow Mr. Germain. In any case, I shall present argument. I am, as the Marshal said, Bert Garcia, and this is my co-counsel, Mr. John Stone. Together, we shall present argument for Mary Thornton in this case. The case at the trial level that we're here before today, it was a negligence case involving the plaintiff seeking damages for the negligent preparation and delivery of the body of the plaintiff's husband and father to a wake in Louisiana by the defendant's funeral home. Trial was had to a jury, and the judgment entered on the verdict for the defendant. Shortly after the judgment date, we discovered another eyewitness that we presented in a motion for new trial to the trial court. This missing witness was, as I say, an eyewitness and the only eyewitness that was available that could testify concerning the time that the body had been laying in its condition before the first member of the family saw him. We, as I said, filed a motion for new trial, presented evidence on the motion for new trial. The motion for new trial was eventually overruled by operation of law. I would like to stress at this point that this overruling of the motion for new trial by operation of law was the only appealable error that we were complaining about at the Court of Appeals level. Nothing at the jury trial or during the trial was anything that we were complaining about. It was only the overruling of the motion for new trial. Appeal was perfected and made to the Court of Appeals. A motion for extension of time to file a statement of fact was denied it. Therefore, the appeal to the Court of Appeals was wholly ineffective without the statement of fact. It is this denial of the extension of time in which to file a statement of fact that we are here complaining about, and the only reason that we're here. Our brief contains 4 points of error. We, however, will only discuss points 1, 2, and 3. We understand that argument was only granted on point 1, but like Mr. Jamel, we are seeking some dicta from this court concerning points 2 and 3. The points of error briefly are as follows. This point of error number 1 is that we timely filed a reasonable explanation for an extension of time for the filing of the statement of fact pursuant to Rule 21C, and yet were denied such extension. That's the point of error that Mr. Stone will discuss with you. I will discuss points 2 and 3 very, very briefly. I stress very, very briefly. And those points are that the combined application of the new Rule 329B and 386 and the old Rule 21C through the standard steps in the progeny of cases terminating in meshwork versus meshwork is an unconstitutional deprivation of equal protection and due process. The order of argument will be that I, as I said, will very briefly present the facts of the case and the time sequence as I am the person that tried and presented the motion for new trial to the trial court. Mr. Stone will more in detail discuss point of error number 1, which, as I've said, is the point of error that was granted and presumably the point of error that this court would like to hear argument about. I would like to stress before beginning with the time sequence that we feel very strongly that point of error number 1 is sufficient for a remand, which is what we're seeking, a remand to the Court of Appeals. Let us argue with our statement of fact. However, in the interest of completeness, I would like to say a word about this discrepancy that we feel has arisen under the new Rule 329B and 386. The sequence of events, I hope that the court can see the chart I have before him. If not, that chart is duplicated in our brief in the appendix. It is the first appendix. Beginning from the date that judgment was signed, and that was May 21st of 1981, that is the first relevant date. Thereafter, as I said, we found the witness that we were seeking on June the 2nd, 1981. It took us about 2 weeks. The witness was found, I might add, by one of the plaintiffs and not by us. It took us a couple of weeks to get in touch with the witness and determine what she could say. And consequently, the motion for new trial was filed on June 16, 1981, thereby extending, according to the rules,
our dates for the filing of the statement of facts to August the 28th. On August the 16th, or 10 days thereafter, we had a hearing on the motion for new trial and presented evidence, and Short presented the Sister Mary Jo Evelo to testify. I might add that Sister Evelo was not allowed to testify, but she was present and could have testified if the trial judge had wanted her to. Several days after the hearing on the motion for new trial,
June 26th.
As I said, that this chart is duplicated in our brief in the appendix. At the hearing on the motion for new trial, the judge indicated that he might rule on our motion for new trial. However, he did not, and several days thereafter, he began his vacation. He was completely unavailable to us until the 1st or 2nd of August, at which time he returned. The day after he returned from his vacation, we went to his chambers and asked if he were going to rule on our motion for new trial. He was noncommittal at that time, didn't indicate what he was going to do, and 2 days after that, or 3 days after that, on August the 4th, the motion for new trial was overruled by operation of law. That, I stress, is the only appealable error, the only error that we had to complain of at the Court of Appeal. From that point until August the 28th, which was the date that our statement of facts was due, was 25 days. The statement of facts and appeal was perfected on August the 18th, on August the 25th, 3 days before the statement of facts was due, and 18 days before the time allowed to us by Rule 21C in which to request a motion for an extension of time, we filed such a motion for an extension of time. And the motion, as I said, was denied. The case was heard before the Court of Appeals without a statement of facts. I don't need to remind anybody there was a wholly ineffective exercise there. We believe that the way that the new rules 329B, 386, and the way they interact with the old Rule 21C, and the way those three rules are applied through the meshword standard has created a second class of appellants. The appellants that now have only 25 days in which to file their statement of facts as compared to the appellants that have the normal 60-day period. And if the language of meshword is going to be strictly applied, particularly the last phrase in meshword, which says, but was the result of inadvertence, mistake, or mischance. We cannot show, don't have to show, that there was inadvertence, mistake, or mischance in order to be able to show, or in order to be in the box which we were placed in, and that we absolutely cannot do it. It's a practical impossibility. If we can believe what the court reporter tells us, court reporters tell us, that in order for us to file a statement of facts in 25 days. In those 25 days, court reporters, official court reporters, are in court 2 or 3 days out of the week. On Fridays, they're normally have the hearing. In short, by our calculations, this leaves, in essence, leaves 8 days for the court reporter to prepare the statement of facts, not a result of inadvertence, mistake, or mischance. It's really what we choose to term a practical impossibility for the court reporter to prepare the statement of facts, particularly if it's a trial of any length. The trial involved in this case was a day and a half trial, not particularly long, but nonetheless, a practical impossibility for the court reporter to prepare the statement of facts in that brief time. Consequently, it is our position that if this language of meshword is to be strictly applied by the courts of appeals in denying or allowing motions for extension of time to file the statement of facts, then it results in an effective foreclosure of the appellant's right to be heard, which is the essence of equal protection and due process. I am about to sit down and let Mr. Stone, as I say, address the point which we presume the court really wants to hear argument about, but I would like to, just before sitting down, stress to this court that we believe we are entitled to remand on point of error number one. We are hoping for some clarification of the language of meshwork by our argument on points of errors number 2 and 3. Thank you very much.
May it please the court, Mr. John Stone will continue arguing for petition.
May it please the court, I have the dubious distinction, as Mr. Garcia pointed out, of being the person who prepared the application for writ of error. I'd like to take just a second to thank the court for granting me the opportunity to present oral argument on at least one of the points that I asserted. I'll try to focus on the point that the court seemed to express its interest in from our brief, that being point of error number one. I'll try to cover what that point requires, the facts that I believe this court will need in order to be able to rule on that point of error, and then try to demonstrate how the facts fit with the law that prevailed on the day in question and show that we're entitled to the relief that we're seeking, that being a remand to the Court of Appeal. This is a Rule 21C application, and I noted that at the outset today, the court ruled on another 21C. This has been a troublesome rule to this court from my reading of many of the cases from the time that the reasonable explanation standard was inserted into this particular rule. The courts of appeal all tried to deal with it in whatever manner they saw fit up until the time that this court announced its decision in Meshwork versus Meshwork. So I'm sure the court has heard much of what I probably will cover today regarding the language of the statute and how it should be interpreted. But it is a statutory problem that we're faced with, and therefore language is, of necessity, is important. In order to resolve the issue that's before this court, you have to determine whether or not we presented a reasonable explanation to the Court of Appeals. It occurs to me that in order to be able to decide that, you need to know, first of all, what explanation we presented, and secondly, what legal standard the Court of Appeals was required to superimpose over the facts that we presented to them. To begin with, the explanation that was presented. You'll find in my application on page 7 and 8 a chronological summary of the events that occurred, and in there you'll discover that we provided five documents containing information pertinent to the issue to the Court of Appeals. They were all filed on a timely basis. I believe that's important. The first is the official transcript of the cause. Those documents obviously contained information regarding the timing of when the motion for new trial was presented, on what day it either was ruled on or in this case was not ruled on, and so forth. Documents in the transcript also contained some kind of an indication of what Sister K. Jo Evelo, the newly discovered witness, would testify about if allowed to. Her affidavit was contained as an annex to the motion for new trial. So there was quite a bit of information simply contained in the official transcript of what happened at the lower court. Petitioner next filed its motion for an extension of time in which to file a statement of facts. This, although a very brief motion that was filed with the court, contained the salient points. It demonstrated to the court that we were faced with a situation of only 25 days in which to obtain the statement of facts. And we attached to that the third document the court had, an affidavit from the court reporter indicating that she, in fact, only had approximately 8 or 9 days in which to prepare the statement of facts from the original trial and the dialogue from the hearing on the motion for new trial. After all, we were going to complain of an abuse of discretion on the part of the trial judge in failing to grant us a new trial. That's the only thing we were going to complain of. The court reporter's affidavit, as I said, was the third document provided. The fourth document provided was, I'll call it, petitioner's supplement to its motion for an extension of time. Actually, what it was counsel for Fenlon had objected to our extension of time and had filed a reply to my motion, and I provided supplemental information to the Court of Appeals to answer the questions raised in his objection, my request for an extension of time. In that document, it was approximately 5 pages in length. It listed a chronology of events, the events that were pertinent. It cited cases and authorities that the Court of Appeals should look at in order to determine whether or not I was presenting a reasonable explanation. And it was the first time that I was able to point out to the Court of Appeals what I thought perhaps they had not seen, that there was only one error being complained of by the plaintiffs below, and that was the overruling of our motion for a new trial. We were not using this as an avenue for a continuance or for any kind of dilatory tactic whatsoever. We were not complaining of any act on the part of the trial judge or anyone else during the trial. No appealable error at all existed until this date and time. And this was the first opportunity I had to actually point that out to the Court of Appeals. The fourth document provided to the Court of Appeals was petitioner's motion for rehearing. This was in excess of 50 pages. It looked remarkably similar to the application for writ of error which I submitted to this court. It was in that format. It cited a complete history, as I saw it, of the development of the meshwork standard. It cited in excruciating detail the events that had taken place. It even contained in it a step-by-step analysis of what we had done on a day-by-day basis from the time that the appealable event occurred until the statement of fact was requested and it was realized that we would have insufficient time in order to provide the court of appeal. This is located, this document, at Appendix 3, application for writ of error. I apologize for the quality of it. It's simply a blow-up of this document.
Just if I understood the Court of Appeals, what they denied you on was the fact that you didn't do anything about getting the record prior to that date you circled, August the 4th.
Justin, I think you raised an interesting question. It's one that's caused me great dilemma, and that
prior
is...
Prior to 1981, the... record was predicated on the date the motion for new trial was overruled.
That is correct.
The court amended 386. We thought to make that date certain back to the date of the judgment. Now, would you say that we should have to, that we should go back to the date of overruling the motion for new trial?
I confess when I wrote my application for writ of error, I intended, if you allowed me to stand here today and argue just that. But I don't see that that solves some of the evils you
all... There's a lot of cases under the old rules. I'm not talking about 21C. I'm talking about 386. That if you wait too late to order your record, and that's the cause of it, that's not good cause for enough time to file your record. Wait until the last order of the statement of facts or the transcript.
Your Honor, there is a difference. And the difference, I think, is absolutely critical, and it's why I claim this to be a case of first impression here today. All of those cases, and in fact every case cited by not only our side, but by Fenlon and before you today, never had to deal with the issue of requesting a statement of facts prior to the time that the appealable event even occurred. Here the only appealable event was the overruling of the motion for new trial. In order to require us to have designated the transcript and requested the statement of facts any sooner, you're about to approach the realm of requiring us to do it prior to the commission of the event.
Before 1981, if you filed a motion for, if it was a jury case,
yes,
you had to file a motion for new trial.
Correct.
And every point was predicated on the trial court erred in not granting you a new trial. Every point would be predicated on that. This is not a new point that the trial court erred in denying you a new trial. Your point is the trial court erred in denying you a new trial because of newly discovered evidence.
It's my reading of the rules, Your Honor, that prior to 1981, prior to this most recent amendment, at the time you filed a motion for a new trial, it stopped the clock. You had 60 days from the date on which the court overruled your motion for a new trial. This isn't the case here. We had 25 days from the date on which the trial court overruled our motion for a new trial. Albeit we had 100 days from the date on which the judgment was signed, but the judgment has no relationship at all with the appealable event. We
Counsel,
were satisfied with the...
When the rule was written, it was an effort to shorten the appeals, and to commence the running of time always from the same event, the date the judgment is signed. Not rendered signed. Really, this whole case gets down, it would seem to me, to the simple question, did the trial judge did the court abuse its discretion in not giving you some more time?
I agree, Your Honor. That is the point.
If there's a problem here, it would occur to me that it's not in the rule, it's in the fair exercise of discretion.
I believe, Your Honor, that that is the problem in this case. The point I began to try to answer just a minute ago was that we really don't know the basis of the decision of the Court of Appeals here today. Unfortunately, two words brought us all to Austin: overruled and denied. We don't have the benefit of the wisdom of what actually this court focused on when it exercised its discretion. And so, unfortunately, I think we have to construct what the facts were, what the law was, and see if the court properly applied the law to the facts. And if they did not, then as this court ruled in Walters, I believe we were entitled to an extension of time. I had, of course, great preparation, but for the sake of time, let me jump right to the Walters standard. And I am sorry that the justice whose name appears as the author of that decision is not present today, but he will hear the tape, and perhaps he can comment on whether I've properly interpreted what I perceive to be a change in the position of this court in the Walters decision. Quite frankly, Walters begins by reciting verbatim the meshwork standard, and it recites it on page 303 of 623 Southwest 2nd 301. And it says that the meshwork standard declares that reasonably explaining means any plausible statement of the circumstances indicating that a failure to file within the 60-day period was not deliberate or intentional, but was the result of advertence, mistake, or mischance. However, we find on the subsequent page an analysis of the factors that the court actually considered in determining whether Mr. Walters was entitled to an extension of time, and we note that the factors seem to be somewhat different than anything that we've noticed before. The factors that I find in Walters are that A, there was timely compliance with all prerequisite steps. There's no question, we timely complied with all prerequisite steps. The second factor is that the only failure on the part of the appellant was that he failed to provide a statement of facts. I think in his case he also didn't file his brief because he was waiting for the statement of facts. But the point is that the statement of facts was a document over which, I'd like to point out to the court, the appellant has essentially very little control. The court reporter works for the court. The court reporter obviously subject to mandamus from the Court of Appeals, but that's a pretty extraordinary remedy when a court reporter has a heavy caseload or for any other reason unknown to the appellant's attorney says that they cannot get out the statement of facts. You're essentially holding the appellant's attorney responsible for the conduct of someone outside of his control to a great degree. Now, I agree if you have to place the burden somewhere, that's probably the appropriate place to place it. The third factor I find in Walter's test is that a 21C motion is timely filed. Again, I believe we've met all three steps so far. The fourth step then would be that the appellant's motion under 21C must show the reason he could not complete his appellate steps was because the court reporter would not or could not provide the statement of facts that was necessary to complete the appellate steps. We also did that. It must be supported by an affidavit from the court reporter confirming the allegation that the court reporter will not or cannot provide the statement of facts. We complied with that. Then the Walters rule occurs in the remainder of that paragraph. And I call it the Walters rule because it isn't the meshwork standard. It says, the fact that the court reporter, due to no fault of Walters, could not or would not prepare the statement of facts within the time allotted by the Court of Appeals is a plausible excuse showing that the failure was not deliberate or intentional, period. Significance is that the last sentence, the second standard of meshwork, if you will, doesn't appear. And I don't think Mr. Walters would have been able to comply with it anyway. He didn't have a situation that was characteristic of an inadvertence, a mistake, or a mischance. He had a court reporter in that case that had waited, over a year in order to generate this particular statement of fact. The point is this. The standard that's announced, I think, is the appropriate standard. It gets very close to the same type of standard that Chief Justice Nye in Hilliard versus Fennell enunciated back in 77, 2 months before this court was asked to decide meshwork. It's a more discretionary standard, not a less discretionary standard. It says, what I must show is, first, all of these facts, and then show that my failure to file was not deliberate or intentional. I don't think there's one evidentiary item in the record of this cause to show that we intentionally or deliberately waited to request the record in this case, the statement of facts. Quite frankly, we had such a meritorious motion for new trial in our evaluation, we fully expected that it would be granted. And when it was not granted, we determined that that represented an abuse of discretion and was our first and only point of error. My difficulty with the old rules and the new rules is quite frankly just that, is that all of the old cases dealt with situations in which the appealable event had already occurred, even under the old rules applicable to motions for new trial. When the motion for new trial was filed, the clock stopped. The record could wait. When the judge determined he would not grant you your new trial for whatever reason, then the clock began to run and you had a minimum of 2 months. Had we had 2 months in this case, I submit we would not have needed an extension of time. That's the amount of time that the court reporter claimed she needed in order to get out this particular statement of facts. So we have found ourselves in the unfortunate circumstance of waiting till the appealable event occurred and then only having 25 days within which to comply with the rules. I think there is no question that the intent of the rules is clear, was to simplify the computation of the appellate steps and to expedite the appellate process. I said when I wrote my writ of error, I intended to tell the court, if given the opportunity, you need to rewrite the rule. It won't solve the problem.
Counsel, the meshwork rule uses identically the language of a well-settled rule that's announced in Craddock versus Sunshine Motors Company. That was the phraseology there, you know, about mischance and whatever it was. That's a settled principle in Texas. It occurs to me still. Leave the rule alone. We come back to the same question. Is impossibility good reason? And if impossibility is good reason, then a judge abuses his discretion. And that's what your lawsuit gets down to, it would occur to me.
I could not agree more, Chief Justice. I could not agree more.
The rule was adopted to get away from Matlock versus Matlock. Mm-hmm. If everybody would do what he's supposed to timely, we wouldn't need rules. If men were angels, we wouldn't need courts. But there's no rule that will satisfy every situation.
I agree completely, Your Honor. As I began to say, I intended to say you needed to change the rule. I have since come to change my opinion of my original opinion. I don't think changing the rule is necessary. In fact, I don't think it would solve the problem. There are rocky roads in every direction from where this court is right now, and the least rocky of those is to look at this case on its extremely unique facts and narrowly interpret the case that's presented here today and the point of error that is presented here today. The facts are the only appealable error was the motion for new trial. We did not use this as a method to get a continuance to obtain more time to prepare an appeal based on errors committed at trial. So we're not in that category of evils that I think the court meant to address in some of its earlier considerations changing this rule. The only appealable event was the motion for new trial being overruled by operation of law. And only when it's overruled by operation of law are as few as 25 days allowed in which to get the statement of facts. In fact, if I file a motion for a new trial, the day the judgment is signed and the judge sees no merit in it and overrules it on that day, I've just purchased 100 days in which to get my statement of facts before the Court of Appeals. I would suspect some clever practitioners might even attempt to do that out there with the rules as they stand right now. File somewhat less than meritorious motions for a new trial simply to extend the amount of time required to perfect the record. Not the case in our situation. Also, this was the type of an appeal where the rules of this court compelled a motion for a new trial. This was not an option, and I think this is one of the aspects of our suggestion that there might be a constitutional implication. We were compelled to seek a new trial. New evidence is directed at Rule 329. And the only other factor, the fourth factor, pardon me, red light tripped me up quite a bit. The only other factor that exists in our unique fact circumstances and therefore should help you with the narrow construction of this is that motion for new trial was the only thing being complained of. The I'm sorry, my train of thought is derailed. I apologize, Your Honor. On rebuttal, I'll attempt to make sure I state my position clearly. Thank you.
Your argument from the respondent.
May it please the court, Gerald Latin will present argument for respondent.
May it please the court, I also would like to express my appreciation at the opportunity to argue before this honorable body. And I would like to say, although I don't want to introduce levity at an inappropriate time, my partner before I left said, Gerald, who would ever have thought that you would be defending rules that you've wrestled with and cussed for so long? I think Mr. Justice Pope has hit the nail on the head that the problem is not with the rules, but with whether or not the Court of Appeals, the Ninth Court of Appeals, which incidentally was the articulator of the meshwork doctrine as it came on up into before this court, whether it abused its discretion. But I would like to call the court's attention to this one very critical point, and that is that the Court of Appeals must arrive at its discretionary decision on the basis of the explanation that is before it. It doesn't have any machinery to call in witnesses. It doesn't have hearings to have attorneys come and explain to them why they need an extension of time. It must rely on the written record that is made by the person who is requesting an extension of time. That's a critical point that I think this court needs to look at, and it needs to look at the quality of the explanation that was given by the petitioners in this case. Now, of course, Mr. Justice Pope again accurately stated the issue here as to whether or not the Court of Appeals had abused its discretion, but I think that broad issue can be broken down into three fundamental elements, and if these elements can be answered, then it can be answered as to whether or not the Court of Appeals abused its discretion in refusing to grant an extension of time. I think the first element of the issue is whether or not the appellant, Mary Thornton, was diligent in promptly requesting a statement of facts. What was their diligence in this case? Second of all, whether or not there was inadequate time for the preparation of a statement of facts. And thirdly of all, whether or not the appellant's diligence or lack thereof, and whether or not the impossibility of preparing a statement of facts was adequately explained to the Court of Appeal so that it could make a fair determination of whether or not it should grant an extension of time. I feel, Your Honors, that if the appellant failed in any one of those three, then an abuse of discretion has not been shown. The issue here is important because I think that if this opinion is published and the court reporter's affidavit is set out in the opinion, then there will have been an effective emasculation of the meaning of Rule 386. And Rule 21C will have been placed above it to the extent that there will no longer be a time requirement for the filing of the statement of fact. As Mr. Justice Pope pointed out during Appellee's argument, there need be no rules for the diligent. The rules are created for the persons who are either too busy or too non-diligent to recognize the coming of an event. The rules were set up so that everybody would know that from the date of judgment, 100 days was given in order to file a statement of fact. That's May 21st in this case, until August 29th. Appellants knew that. They filed their motion for new trial. There was a hearing thereon.
What was the date of the hearing again?
June the 26th, I believe it was, Your Honor.
June the 26th. if the judge had ruled, we probably wouldn't have had this lawsuit. But he held it and held it and then he went on vacation.
As was his right, I would point out to the court, to allow it to be overruled by operation of law. At any rate, Your Honor, my point is this. These attorneys and the petitioners knew the nature and extent of the statement of fact. They knew how approximately or roughly how long it would be. They knew that it was going to be due on August the 29th. And yet, during all the time up until August the 4th, I guess that appears on the other chart, they took no steps whatsoever to accomplish the production of the statement of fact. Now, the fact that there was no appealable error until August the 4th does not seem to me to be equal to you don't have to do anything until the time arises when the appeal is necessary.
You're not suggesting that they go to the expense of getting up a statement of fact while they wait
on the ruling? No, sir, I'm not suggesting that. That may be appropriate in some cases. As you know, diligence and promptness depend on the circumstances of the case. I'm not suggesting that they have to do that in every case. But I am suggesting to the court that according to the petitioner's own chart, they did not even contact the petitioners, and the petitioners did not contact the attorneys with reference to an appeal until 3 days after the motion for a new trial had been overruled. It would seem to me that diligence would require that on August the 1st, or possibly July the 27th, when it became apparent that the trial court was not going to arrive at a quick decision, they might have gotten in touch with the petitioners here and said, listen, we've got to start considering the contingency of appeal. They might have at that time, during that time, gotten in touch with the court reporter and said, we're going to state the fact, but can you give us some idea as to how long it will be, how long it will take you to type it up, and how much it's going to cost us? This is to me minimal diligence, Your Honor. But in response to my opposition to their motion for an extension of time in the Court of Appeal, they stated, suffice it to say, that nothing that happened before August the 4th is relevant to whether or not this court should grant an extension of time. It seems to me that the appellants owed a duty to the Court of Appeals and to this court to decide as time went along whether or not, in the event of an overruling of a motion for a new trial, they were going to appeal their case. They didn't even write to the appellants, so the appellants didn't contact them on the date the motion was overruled. The first letter went out 3 days after August the 4th. I think that the petitioner's own charts will show that. The next step, of course, was to perfect the appeal. And I believe that was done on August the 18th. Now, if they had known they wanted to appeal on August the 4th, they could have ordered the statement of fact at that time. That would have been diligent. The court reporter could then have told the Court of Appeals, or you gentlemen through this affidavit, how long it was going to take her as of August the 4th. But the statement of facts was not requested until 2 days after the appeal was perfected. It was requested on August the 20th. There was a designation sent to the clerk designating the statement of fact. But it's my understanding that the court reporter isn't under a duty to go down to the clerk's office every day to see what designations have been made. That the burden is upon the appellant to contact the court reporter and advise the court reporter as to the need of a statement of fact. But this was not done until 2 days after the appeal was effected and more than 2 weeks after August the 4th of 1981.
Well, they say the 18th, which would be 2 weeks today from the motion being overruled.
Yes, Your Honor. I think if you will check the record, you'll find that date, August the 18th, is when the designation was sent to the clerk. But if you will look at the court reporter's affidavit, it states clearly that, quote, someone from Mr. Garcia's office called me this morning, and the affidavit is dated August the 20th, and asked me for a statement of facts.
Who is that, his wife have?
Yes, sir. There are two sets of affidavits, Your Honor. One from virtually every court reporter in Jefferson County, and the other, which was attached to the motion for extension of time. I don't have the page that first affidavit was submitted on, but I trust that the court can see it, and when the court does, the court will see that the court reporter was not requested to promulgate a statement of facts until August the 20th, 9 days before the statement was due, and more than 2 weeks after the only thing they were complaining of on appeal had occurred.
What? But if the court reporter couldn't have gotten the statement of facts in timely, if she'd been asked on August the 4th, which apparently she couldn't have, based on the affidavits, what difference does it make when it was requested?
Well, that's the important thing, Your Honor. We don't know what she could have done effective August the 4th. She states that from August the 20th she can't get it in for 60 days. But there is no statement as to what she could have done if she had been asked on August the 4th.
Well, there's a second affidavit saying there's no way she can do it in 25 calendar days.
If the court will read that affidavit carefully, it is a duplicate affidavit of many, many court reporters, and what they're talking about there is, in the normal case, the average time when the court is in session, it's an umbrella affidavit. It does not apply to this particular case. It's an affidavit that parrots other affidavits that, frankly, just tells me that the court reporters are having problems with the new rule. But it does not speak to this case.
Well, it tells me that the court reporters are not doing their job. We have problems with the court reporters in general.
Well, I'll not comment on that, Your Honor.
Well,
I have to go back to the county.
That's the delay period on the appellate. Our records show that is the period of delay right now.
Yes, sir.
The time getting the record ready.
Yes.
Not the time it's filed and disposed of.
Yes, sir.
I know that this is out of the record, Mr. Flatton, but you've tried a number of lawsuits. Have you ever known one where the court reporter got it out 25 days after request?
Well, Judge, no, I don't have any personal recollection. But now that leads me to the next point. And that is, what explanation was given to the Court of Appeals? Now, we can sit up here and talk about how I can't remember one being done in 25 days. I can't remember one being done in 10 days. I can't maybe remember one. I remember one wasn't done in 2 years. But the Court of Appeals is looking at this case. Now, what counsel submits to this court is that under Walters, if he can show an impossibility, then he is entitled to an extension. So what does that mean, show an impossibility? Now let's look at the Walters case, and let's look at the quality of the affidavit that was submitted there. As I recall, the court reporter had hospitalization, had an operation, had nasal problems. As I recall, the court reporter had other matters pending, other statements of fact to be turned in. But what I see the danger of this case being, this affidavit says one thing. It is impossible for me to get out a statement of fact. Now, what I'm saying to the court is that if the court approves that affidavit as a reasonable explanation,